Hello there, friends. This is One Song Number 8. My name is Peter Broderick, and I'm very excited and happy to show you a conversation with Daniel Nickerson today. Over the course of the last month or two, there is one artist I've been listening to the most, and it is Daniel Nickerson. And I met Daniel through our mutual friend, David Allred. David was the first guest on this little podcast. But yeah, I've just been getting to know Daniel a bit more recently, and he's a lovely guy with some absolutely lovely creations. So I hope you like this. I do want to apologize for, you'll hear at the start of this, I mixed up the order of things a little bit. I meant to start off and give some context of how we knew each other and then dive into the music, but I kind of did things a little bit backwards. So I hope it's not too confusing of a listen. I think if you're patient with it and get into it, it turns into a nice conversation. So thanks for tuning in and enjoy.
What is a song? Where do songs come from? What is the life of a song?
How much can a song morph and change before it becomes something else entirely?
What is the essence of one song?
It is one song.
This is one song, one song. See, this is one song. This is one song, one song.
This is one song.
This is one song.
Mr. Daniel Nickerson. Daniel Dickerson. How are you doing today?
Good, Peter. I'm hanging out at home. I watered the garden. Clover, my dog, is sitting next to me. And stuff is good, man. What's going on over there?
Nice. Well, it's funny. Your dog's name is Clover. I was just out picking some clover, some red clover.
Yeah, it's happening.
I like to pick the flowers and dry them to use for tea.
Yeah, totally. We got jars of this stuff.
Nice. Nice. Hey, I have to do these quick. The boss says that I have to start every podcast with these three introductory questions. And they are, how many years have you been on this earth? Where in the world are you now? You kind of already answered that. But and can you please tell me about the last meal that you ate?
Yeah. Okay. So I've been here 29 years. 1991, I was born. Mm-hmm. I think the first George Bush was in office here in the United States of America, which is the country where I am residing right now. And I'm in the state of California, and I'm in Humboldt County, which is in the northern portion of California. You're practically in Oregon, but you're not quite. And I'm in the southern portion of Humboldt County, and I'm in a rural area. The township is called Red Crest, but that's sort of just a name that was splashed across a swath of agricultural and sort of wilderness properties and logging land, forest. But I'm on the side of the Eel River, which is a big watershed in this area. It passes through like five counties, and it empties out to the Pacific nearby here at Ferndale. And so, yeah, I'm about 400 yards away from the Eel River here in southern Humboldt County. Oh. And it's my understanding that this was traditionally the territory of the Sinkyon people. I've been trying to learn. I used to live in Arcata and Eureka and Humboldt Bay, about an hour north of here. And that was known to be the Wiat people. But here, the Sinkyon was another loose name given to a bunch of different semi-nomadic tribes along the river. And some of those people are still around, and there is an intertribal Sinkyon council, but a lot of those people that were here just 100, 150 years ago were killed during the colonization period. As a big part of how I understand where I am is trying to think about that story, and that story around here is only about 150 years ago. So that's where I am here. Red Crest, if you send me a letter. And I'm on a farm too. It's called Luna Farm, and I work here. It's a CSA and market farm doing organic produce, fruits and veggies.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say for people over here in Europe that, because the term CSA, I think, is a very American thing. It's community-supported agriculture, right? So it's like where people support the farm, and it's like a co-op almost, where people, they kind of buy in for an amount of the harvest each year. Is that it?
Yeah, you pay up front. Yeah, the farmers love it because they get a bunch of customers to pay them a full season's worth of buy a full season's worth of produce at the start of the season, so then the farmers can fund their farming season, and they deliver weekly produce boxes to the subscribers, basically. Yeah, and it's also an organic farm, which is a USDA certification. So for international people, yeah, I don't know if the word organic is so savvy.
We use everywhere the word else, or organic what it over means. Here as well, yeah.
Totally.
But there's a lot of tricksters using the word organic nowadays too. It doesn't always signify, in my mind, it doesn't always signify the most natural of processes. But it's a good start anyway.
Totally. You got to pay to play, and you can put the badge on your produce that you have it. That's kind of what the deal is around here. And it means that you use a certain set of approved things added to your soil and, to fight pests, but you don't use other things. That's another story. But to finish answering your question, I ate an apple and cheese with a glass of carrot juice.
Fantastic.
My last meal.
Apples.
I
and
considered
cheese.
Having just cheese and carrot juice for the full orange experience, but I craved some apple.
My dad used to eat a lot of apples and cheese when I was a kid. Like, he'd slice up an apple and then slice up cheese and like put a slice of apple together with a slice of cheese.
And, that's the meal.
I need to go and try that again.
You haven't had that recently? I thought everybody had
that. Not recently. I had today. See, I haven't mentioned this yet on this platform, but I've been working on an organic farm myself over here, which is part of why I'm really curious to talk to you today, because there's something somewhat similar in what we're both doing, in that we're a bit in that world and also in the music world. But today at my lunch break on the farm, I had some bread with cheese and jam.
Yeah.
And the others, yum. Everyone was saying to me, jam and cheese? And I was like, yeah. You know, when I lived in Denmark and Germany, that was super common to put, you know,
or like a jam hard cheese or like a soft
honey.
Cheese.
On cheese, but yeah, I think people here in Ireland aren't super familiar with that concept. But apples and cheese, jam and cheese, Daniel, what's going on here?
And I don't know, been here 29 years, bet there's another 29 still to do, at least, you know. My great grandma lived to 110.
That's very encouraging. So
we got good genes,
yeah.
So she had really good handwriting. I think it kept getting better the longer she lived. By the end, her handwriting was the best you could imagine. That's awesome.
When you say good handwriting, do you mean like, because my grandmother has the most beautiful handwriting, but it can be very difficult to read because it's very ornate cursive.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That good is just one word we could use to describe it.
Yeah.
But it sure had a lot of curvature and shape to it.
Beautiful. And tell me about the place you're living in, because I just saw some photos you put up of the construction of this kind of dome, or not a dome, but like a circular kind of structure. What's that all about? It looks beautiful.
Yeah, so I'm halfway through moving still, and my partner Taylor Ann and I and our dog Clover moved into this structure that a bunch of friends and builders helped us put up. It's called a yurt. It's based off of a traditional structure, Mongolian structure. Nomadic people would use, live in high wind areas on the mountains. But we just popped it up in the corner of a pumpkin and melon field here on the farm.
Wow.
And we planted some fruit trees around it. And there's about 30 feet that way, there's a logging land. So there's a bunch of second and third growth redwoods mixed with other trees, bay laurel trees. But for most of this area around us is logging land owned by Green Diamond Company. And we were hearing logging yesterday, which sounds like gunshots.
Wow.
Crazy gunshots.
Gunshots? It actually sound like gunshots. Yeah. I would think it sounds like saws and stuff.
Because it's like miles away, whatever sound you're hearing. And you're mostly just hearing the sound of the impact. Sometimes you'll hear a series of sounds, which is impact of branches around it, I think. I don't know. It's kind of crazy. But it hits the ground and you can hear it. But yeah, crazy. So that's what's going on. We like dug a big hole in the ground.
I'm pulling up a few pictures of yurts here for people.
Yeah, exactly.
I can see what it looks like. It's so cool. I'm very intrigued myself. I do intend to talk about music at some stage, but I'm really
what?
As you can see, I get sidetracked, and
is that?
That's cool. Very cool.
Music is something we do inside buildings or out on land outside of buildings. But those land and buildings are so interesting. The structure is really simple. The walls and the ceiling are burnished dug for beams, and walls are a lattice structure, which means that it's an expanding web and it contracts. And so when it came here, it was just this kind of compacted little group of boards, but then it expanded to cover this entire 30-foot diameter circular platform that we built. Mm-hmm. And then the roof is a bunch of beams going towards a center circle. And so you can kind of see, if anybody's looking so online, cool, there's a little plastic dome up in the ceiling, and circular structure. The walls have a layer of insulation, and then they have an exterior, which is sort of like a laminated vinyl, like a plasticky canvas sort of experience. Mm-hmm. And there's some windows, and it's kind of amazing. It's like the biggest, best you've ever been.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. Pretty well insulated. We'll see how winter goes.
Cool. Well, we're going to talk today about a song of yours called Changing the Mind is Fun. It's part of a new project that you sent over, where it's, well, this recording of the song is in a group of recordings that you did, which you describe as a sort of one-man band thing, right? Where you're playing percussion with your feet and then playing guitar and singing. Yeah. Do you want to tell a little bit about it?
I just recorded it live in a day, like a performance. And it's when the lockdown happened, I had been starting to play with some drummers and stuff and was getting really excited about hearing a beat. But then it was sort of couldn't hang out with people so easily. And so I got some drums and some bass. I got a marching snare drum and a big Ludwig bass drum and a couple bass drum pedals. And I started just kind of being able to play the backbeat while I'd practice guitar. But I really liked it. And so it's like a little band in a box. Oh, and it was just a simple way.
Sorry.
It's just a simple way to like challenge myself to do something slightly different while just continuing to play folk music. Just sit down and pick up some instruments and play a song you wrote, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been interested in that sort of thing ever since I started. Like, I've always like had a gaggle of instruments around me wherever I go and like trying to use all my extremities to play as many different things. And I just love that sort of thing. And when I first heard your recordings, I was very curious my mind goes to like, what's his setup to that he can play a snare drum with his foot. And so, you know, I want to talk about the meaning of the song as well, but I thought maybe before we get into that, since we have a couple different versions of the song we can go to, like the music video thing and the recording, maybe we could just play the music video first, let the song kind of speak for itself, and then we could sort of, people can see how it is performed, and then we could sort of come back and talk about, you know, the deeper meanings of the song. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds like a plan, Peter.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, let's get in there. There's another little introductory bit that I wanted to get to that I skipped, but maybe I can go back to that in a moment.
Oh, your theme song.
Oh, no. That I'll put in afterwards.
Oh, but, good.
But
good.
This is, let's see here. You just shot this a couple weeks ago, did you?
Just right before moving out of our old place. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Let's check it out.
Wee 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 wee.
Awesome.
Whoa.
How? Sorry, that may, I realize that may be slightly torturous, making you sit there and watch yourself.
I've seen it before.
Okay.
It's all good.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, before we go into the meaning of this song, there's one other introductory bit that I really want to get to, which is to give a bit of context as to how you and I know each other. It's through a mutual friend of ours, Mr. David Allred.
Yeah.
David.
Cheater.
Cheater.
He got the nickname Cheaters and skate skills. He was amazing. I wasn't actually around, but our friend Rory told me this story the other day. When David was in like seventh grade or something, he could do the crazy, you know, like kick flip that everybody was trying to figure out how to do, and nobody could do it but David. And everyone was like, "You're a cheater, man. You cheated."
That's so ridiculous, because you can't possibly do a kickflip without actually just doing it.
He has the nickname for years.
Wow. Well, I have lots of different nicknames for David. But yeah, as people can probably tell, you've known David since you were very young. When did you actually guys first meet?
Well, high school. Ninth grade, yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And so like David and I kind of first met when he moved up to Oregon. And at that time, I think he first moved into the place you were living in, right?
Yeah.
Is that right? And
totally.
That's how I met you. I came over when I was just getting to know David, and I met you at that place in Southeast Portland. And I have this distinct memory of hearing some music on, like in the kitchen or something. And it was like some pump organ and vocals. And I loved the sound of it. And I said, I either asked you or David, I said, "Well, who is this?" And the answer was Michael Hurley. And Michael Hurley was a name I knew very well already, but that was my first time consciously listening to him, you know? And so that's another thing you and I share, I think, is a deep love for Michael Hurley. Do you want to say anything about that?
Oh, man, I love that stuff. Yeah. I moved to Portland when I was 18. And in that first few months, some friends and I went to a vegan deli in Southeast. And Michael Hurley was there playing a 3-hour set. You know, he was just kind of clocking in a shift, and just playing tunes. And we were kind of like squirrely kids, but I got to sit down just right next to his foot. And he was just playing through a little guitar amp and had a little vocal mic, and got to listen to him play for 3 hours. And he was kind of tapping his toe the whole time and playing songs he wrote and playing kind of weird old blues and country tunes, and just working too. He was a working musician. He just playing the Thursday night gig at the vegan deli in Southeast, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just really amazing. And I've just been listening to it constantly ever since. Some of my favorite stuff to put on always makes me feel good.
Fantastic. Yeah. And the amazing thing is, like you just said, like no one's really been gigging the last years, but up until when I left Oregon in 2016, he would still do weekly gigs in Astoria and Portland, these real kind of like, you know, several hours long gigs where drunk people are talking over him. Meanwhile, Michael Hurley also gets invited to play concert halls in Australia, you know, like he's such an interesting character, because he's in some ways he's a real legend and a cult figure. But in other ways, he's just a super normal guy that just plays music. And that's really beautiful, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the tradition of what a musician as a profession is. Like a heavily promoted album or tour is like a pretty recent phenomenon, but a gig has been around. I mean, a gig is a gig. You show up to the gig, you play the tunes, pay you at the end of the night. That's a job, you know.
Yeah.
It was just really cool seeing and he's an old timer too. He's still working.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. But yeah, that was a bit of a lesson for me, because until then music was something that happened online or in the schools, right. You know, growing up, there wasn't like a authentic folk tradition of real people playing old rep in the suburbs where I grew up, in Sacramento suburbs in Central California. So yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah. One time I was with a group of friends and we were headed out to Astoria, and Michael Hurley kind of lives just outside of Astoria. And one of my friends said, "Hey, maybe we'll see Michael Hurley playing in a bar." And I was like, "Yeah, just because he lives there doesn't mean we're going to see him." And sure enough, we went to a bar in Astoria, and there he was playing in the corner. It was just, you know, it was amazing.
What is the Fort George Brewery?
It was Fort George, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, so
that's a good gig.
yeah, it is a good gig. So so we met there down in Southeast Portland. And, you know, David and I have sort of like done various things together over the years. And, but I kind of, at some stage, I think, you know, I would always ask David, like, what you're up to, you know? And I think maybe you would talk to David and he'd be hanging out with me. So maybe he'd be talking about me. And I think at some point we exchanged records through David. I gave you a copy of, this choir project I was doing, and you gave David a tape to give to me, which I have right here. Sunlight in a Yellow Room. And this tape has become kind of legendary in my family. Like the A side is your originals. It's like four or five songs and then like a nice long ambient piece. And then the B side is like an absolutely stellar mixtape. And you did like a number of these projects, didn't you? Which was like original stuff on the A side and a mixtape on the B side.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's a big box of the taping. Yeah. I've had a boombox that kind of just sits on my desk for the last few years, and you can just plug your, you know, headphone jack into it. So I was like, you know, you get a 90-minute cassette tape and you want to show music with your friends of the B side. You're like, come up with something. So yeah, I've been, I love making mixtapes. I got really obsessed with it actually in the last year and have been, but I haven't really been finishing them. I don't know. It's a longer story, but yeah, that Sunlight in the Yellow Room. I mean, I made probably like 6 copies of that.
Yeah.
And then moved on to the next thing, you know.
It's fantastic.
That's really amazing that you got one.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who, like, if I know that I have something that not many other people know, I tend to like really cherish it, you know, like, ooh, it's my own. And, you know, I like the outsiders, you know, I like the people that like aren't huge and talked about everywhere. Like, I like things that are a little bit more of a secret, you know.
Totally.
Yeah. Which is not to say that you shouldn't blow up and become huge. I would still do my best to like
sounds you. It's painful. sounds painful blowing up.
Yeah.
Or being huge. That reminds me of that scene in Willy Wonka with the girl that eats the berry treat that she's not supposed
to.
Yeah.
Turns into a blueberry. Yeah. Okay. Before we get back to the song, I need to show people this one clip. That's one of my favorite clips on YouTube, if you'll allow. It's you and David and your friend Greg playing the Seinfeld theme when you were teenagers. Do you mind if we watch this?
Oh yeah, that's the summer after freshman year of high school, totally.
Oh, it's just priceless. We need to, just for some additional context, in case you don't recognize Daniel and you're watching this, he's the one with the shaker. All right?
Crappy pop musician.
This is too loud. This might be too loud.
All right.
This good?
Yeah.
That is some great awkward teenage pause at the end of that there.
Yeah. Oh. There's some good bongo fills that Greg did. The second one wasn't as good as the first, but the first one was right on.
He kind of, yeah. He kind of like pulled out his best moves on the first one and then didn't quite follow it.
But it was close. No, it was really close.
No, fantastic. Greg, hats off to you if you ever get the chance to hear this. Man. That's some killer bongo playing.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, man. Tell us about what this song, Changing the Mind is Fun, and what it means to you.
Okay, wow, that was a good one. Yeah, did you read that off the cue card? We've already been so distracted in this conversation. Okay, let's get on point. The point is that this song, what is about? Well, it's what a kind of just. It's not really about anything, but written when I was reflecting on fire season here. You know, fire season in Northern California and drought, big topics around here. I don't know how much it's a thing that people think about internationally, how many other countries are dealing with it, but especially because it affects agriculture and so much of the world's food is grown in California. California drought and wildfire damage, I think, might be international news. But for anybody who doesn't know,
last year, definitely those fires were like, at least over here in Ireland, big news.
Yeah, it's never been worse, you know, as far as anybody knows. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that we could think about, but whatever is going on, it's going on right now. And working on a farm, you're dealing, you're out in the elements, and the August complex, which is the name given to the largest fire in recorded California history, came up through Mendocino County and up to the Humboldt County line and stopped at the Eel River, which is the river that we irrigate the crops from here. And the Mendocino County line is 20, 30 miles. I could fact check that, but way down the line, it's not too close. So evacuating communities, and these are all rural communities and for the most part, agricultural communities too. The major agricultural commodity of this region is cannabis. For anybody who doesn't know that, also Northern California, Southern Oregon, and here the three counties they call the Emerald Triangle are Trinity County, Mendocino County, and Humboldt County.
Uh-huh.
And as far as anybody knows, it's been on the black market for a while, but a lot of cannabis has been grown and distributed throughout the world, coming out of the soil around here and irrigated with the water from this watershed and these rivers around here.
Yeah.
So a lot of people that are living in this area are associated with like a black market industry and are sort of, there's like a liberal consciousness, but there's also an anti-government consciousness because of that, which tends to make the left wing swing around and run into the right wing, if that makes sense. And it's a pretty interesting area. Anyways, fires are whipping through and the evacuation orders are coming down the line, and the farm was on evacuation warning. The farmers live here and, you know, they have their dogs and their stuff here. And so they got the call, the text message, and they said, get ready. We could give an evacuation order at any time if the fire keeps coming in this direction.
Okay.
But until that warning, you know, until that warning becomes like an order, we were going to keep on going and picking produce and bringing it to people at the farmer's market. And so we have markets Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and we pick Monday, Wednesday, Fridays. And so we were just coming out for another day of work, and we stopped for gas on the way down in the morning. And we're listening to the radio. I'm kind of obsessed with the radio, and there's also really good radio in this region. So I might talk about the radio. But I was listening to the radio. I was listening to KMUD, which is a regional station based out of Garberville and Redway, Southern Humboldt, Northern Mendocino County News. And so they're giving updates on fire evacuations and all this crazy stuff. It's been coming down the line for weeks. But that morning while we were filling up gas, it was 9 in the morning, something, sky was still overcast, you know, it should have been bright daylight, but it was dark gray out and there was
Are you there, Daniel?
Yeah.
I lost you at ash, the gray sky, and ash. Can you pick it right back up there?
Yeah, I could pick it back up at ash. Okay, ash is raining down from the sky. All of our technical, you're going to stitch this together.
I will. Post, right? I will.
Man, yeah. It's going to blow everybody's minds. Our Wi-Fi is working great.
Seamless.
Yeah, totally. So we kept on cruising down to the farm, and the sky, as it became day, turned kind of yellowish orange, and then basically all day was sort of like a bright orangey red. And there's sort of this like crazy post-apocalyptic feeling of doing, you know, essentially manual labor beneath like a red sky. A few other things that happened that day that were really far out was the crickets never stopped chirping.
Whoa.
So nighttime, you know, the crickets are out, morning comes, and it was summer, but the day was kind of cool, even though there's fires really nearby. And you know, it was dark. It was kind of this dark red. And yeah, the crickets kept chirping all day, and we are already, you know, we all had face masks because of the pandemic, but we got a box of the M95s, like the superior kind of medical grade stuff you can use when you're doing demo on a house or something.
Right.
And we wore our face masks and we picked tomatoes all day long. So that's just the story. Maybe it sounds kind of crazy to people. Maybe it doesn't, but I mean, it's one of the most far out experiences of my entire life.
Wow.
Because yeah, you're so close to the edge of something that's unknowable, you know, with a tsunami or something, you know, like a storm front moving in, these natural disasters. And so you're just, you're following it like, oh, it's coming closer. Oh, it's coming closer. You're listening to the radio. Is it, how close is it? 35 miles away, I guess. I guess it's not 5 miles away. Like, they'll tell us if it's getting closer. And you
wow.
know, we all have cell phones now, you know, the counties do all this emergency services. And so you're expecting to get a phone call or a text tell you if you're in a bad situation. And so you just keep trying to do, you just keep do what you're here to do.
Yeah.
And so that feeling is something that I've felt a lot this year, as this like slow burn natural disaster going on with the pandemic, and you're hearing about it, but you're just waking up and trying to have another day and just like treat people kindly and do your thing.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of writing a song about it, that just tried to strike a balance between describing what was sort of surreal and scary about the situation, and then the kind of stuff that you say or that you focus on with your friends just to make it through that situation.
Mm. Yeah. When I first heard the song, I kind of, when you first told me kind of where it came from, that story of like picking tomatoes under like a red sky, you know, I was thinking how that's a very apocalyptic scene. And yet the song to me, when I first heard it, I thought, well, that's a very optimistic message. Think it's going to be fine soon. But then I realized, I thought about it some more, and I thought, well, that was my conclusion to it. Like, saying I think it's going to be fine could mean anything, really, couldn't it? It's like, maybe it's going to be fine in the sense that humans will be eradicated and the earth will restore some sort of natural balance, you know, like that could mean so many things, couldn't it?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I'm an optimistic person. I was treated nicely as a child and all this other stuff. I kind of have this, like, this belief that things are going to turn out okay. But you only say that kind of thing is going to be fine. I think we're going to make it. You only say that if you're in a really far out situation where it's in question whether or not things are going to be fine or whether or not you're going to make it, you know?
Yeah.
And we've been saying a lot more of those things to people that we love and care about recently. Like, oh, it's okay, mom. I think it's going to be fine. You know, this pandemic thing, we'll kind of keep cruising by, you know, like, what do you say? What do you say to folks? So,
yeah.
And then there's an element too that I thought I could talk about one of, you know, it's a difficult roundabout way to approach it. But like one of the things I think about when trying to write words is, well, both, you know, trying to write words to a song, trying to make a poem that I want to keep performing, that something that I actually 6 months down the line, you know, I'm writing the song, but 6 months down the line, a year and 6 months down the line, maybe I'll be performing it for people. And when I'm writing it, I have that in mind. Like I want it to be something that feels really good to say, you know, 18 months later.
That's a good,
really good to say. Like,
that's a good thought to have. It's a good foresight.
Totally. Well, I've been writing music since I was 14, you know, and I've written hundreds of these songs and only a few make it through the years. And they're the ones where the words seem like they stay relevant or they're fun to keep saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something I think about. And then another thing, the whole song now to me is like led up to the last line, which was the last thing I wrote. You know, I came up with the melody and I had this do 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 do, and I was playing with some word combinations on the page. So the last line that I came up was changing the mind is fun for everyone, which isn't true. Changing the mind isn't fun for everyone.
Right.
So saying that or being like, why I like that as a piece of poetry is because it's false. Like it's kind of like trying on a crazy costume. Like, can you pull it off? Can you say that line and maybe believe it for a moment?
Yeah.
And
that line really speaks to me because you know, to give a very basic example, like I was somewhat of a picky eater when I was a kid. There was just a lot of things that, you know, my mother would put in front of me and I just turn my nose up and not eat it. But then I experienced this thing in my early adulthood of like trying an avocado and being like, oh my God, avocados are amazing. And I had always thought they were gross before. And so I changed my mind and it was fun. Like to me, I've always had this thought of like, when I learn to like something that I previously thought was terrible, it could be a food, it could be a type of music, it could be a person. For me, if I make up my mind about something and I think it's no good, but then later I come around and realize that I love it, I always feel like that's such a positive thing. Like I've really grown to encompass more of what's out there and to love a greater part of the whole or something, you know?
Totally. I mean, yeah, if you're on that trip, it's a good trip to be interested in changing your mind and adapting and learning to like something that you didn't like before. When I was writing the line, I was just thinking about like dealing with emergency or crisis situations, like, and dealing with anxiety and stress, you know, the mind and anxiety and stress caused by approaching wildfires triggers the mind to do all these things. And one of the things we've had to learn to do this last year is change that trigger so that, you know, when you read the news that morning or something, you're not immediately having a panic attack, because you could have a panic attack every day just by reading the news. So you have to kind of learn how to swallow that pill or stop taking it. And the wildfire thing is so crazy because there's, because, okay, so they're happening, we have to deal with it. And that's, there's a lot to talk about there, but why are the wildfires worse than they've ever been? Why are we in this situation? And that has a lot to do with a very controversial topic in the US called global warming. And that just one component of it, but it also has a lot to do with forestry management practices in our region in the last 150 years. And as I was kind of saying at the beginning, the last 150 years of this region are characterized by a period of colonization. And so white settlers moved into this region and colonized it in the mid-1800s and immediately did a number of things that were probably a really bad idea. Actually, they were definitely a really bad idea.
For the landscape.
But, well, they, I mean, they, colonization, man, they murdered thousands of native people, tens of thousands, maybe even more, you know, if we're just focusing on this area. But they basically waged a war on the first people that were here. And then they waged a war on the natural resources, every natural resource they could find, they waged a war of extraction on it. So everything that had value, starting with the human lives that were here, was devalued or tried to turn into the, tried to translate it into the currency that mattered to the colonists, which was money. So trees and lumber in this region meant money, and unregulated forest and unregulated logging and other extractive practices, including agriculture in 100 years, have led to a really far out ecological situation here where there's this gigantic tinderbox on the edge of our continent that's kind of been created and been made much, much worse by a bunch of people that weren't even here 150 years ago. The people that were here 150 years ago had a really good relationship, and they still do. It's traditional ecological knowledge that fire is good for a landscape.
Yes, it can
which
be.
Is kind of another crazy... Totally, it is. It benefits all these different things. And the people that were living here were doing all sorts of maintenance to the landscape to encourage the right type of fire and discourage the wrong type of fire. And that had a lot to do with selective clearing and harvesting of different resources in really specific ways of harvesting those resources, and also of lighting fires and encouraging fires, because fire brought down a generation of plants, but it also brings back a new generation of plants. Things grow in its wake, and certain foods and medicines that are really important to the first people here were encouraged by burning practices, and they still are, because the tribes in this region, Northern California, still have a presence. The Yurok tribe and the Karuk tribe upriver an hour or two, you know, past Humboldt Bay and then up into the hills on the Klamath River, have a really big presence still. And those tribes are still practicing cultural burns. And they're able to do this because politically, the tribes in this area are considered a sovereign nation and have a certain amount of decision-making freedom within the confines of the American government system, which, in my personal opinion, is a pretty crazy system. Mm-hmm. Other people might have some other ideas, but man, it's some crazy stuff has been done in the name of the American people. So it's kind of cool. We have the, we have these strong presences in our community that are trying to practice traditional cultural burns. And so we have the opportunity to learn from that. And so I'm more of a musician than I am a farmer or an ecological, I'm more of a music and arts person than I am a plant person. But a lot of the people that I spend my time with, including my partner, Taylor Ann, they're plant people. Yeah. And they really care about plants and animals, and they've devoted their whole life to understanding more and more. And so it's pretty cool. We're only one step removed from a lot of the traditional wisdom and knowledge that was almost eradicated during the colonization period. And so I'm telling that whole big, long story because it's really important to tell that story. And because in that story and in the knowledge that was lost, perhaps there's some answers to the questions that are created by the problems we're facing now. And changing the mind is fun, is a way of like reminding myself that the ideas that I was raised on, or that were being the stories that were being told by people in power when I grew up, are not stories that we still need. Mm. We can and probably should be learning new stories. And maybe those stories are old stories, but maybe they're new stories. But the resistance to changing the mind and learning new stories is a tactic that's being employed by people in power in our country, say with like trans rights or something. Like the old story was like trans people are not people, trans girls are not girls. New story is that a person chooses their gender identity, not the government. Okay. But there's a whole bunch of people in powerful positions all across our country that are trying to hold back that shift towards a new consciousness where people can choose their gender identity. And wouldn't it be fun if those people thought that changing the mind was fun? Wouldn't that be great? Then they would be like, oh yeah, trans people, that's great. Let's give them some more freedom. Oh, that's fun, more freedom. There's my like little comic strip version of like why saying that little line is so important to me. And I try and use it all the time, even just like having a conversation with someone about what we should do about something. Like when we were building the platform, we had this idea that we were going to put a wall here. And then there was all these reasons that it shouldn't go there and it should go the other place. And there was like some resistance to changing it. But then it was like, oh yeah, that'd be really nice. Let's change that. And then it made everything way easier. And even at that moment, I was like, yeah, change the mind. Fun.
Yeah.
Fun thing to do.
Absolutely. Frees you up. Absolutely. I mean, we have to hold on to that. I always reserve the right to change my mind on anything, you know, like even something I might be dead sure about right now. Like, I always want the right to be able to change my mind. I don't ever want to be fixed to one idea or philosophy. Like I personally need that freedom to be able to change. Like otherwise it starts to feel very restrictive just personally in my own mind. I really appreciate this conversation. I don't know that many musicians who are have a foot in the music and arts world and another foot sort of in with the plant people. And my own journey the last few years has been very much like, you know, I've tried to put a bit of that out there, some of my foraging and stuff, but like that stuff for me is not just like a fun hobby. Like it's deeply affected my own, just the way that I live and the way that I interact with all the life around me, you know. Like once I started to learn that, oh, those dandelions that are growing in my yard, which I got paid to remove from the yard when I was a kid because they were thought of as pesky weeds, you know, those are an incredible food source and medicine, and they're playing an active role in the acidity content of the soil. They're like an integrated part of this landscape that has great purpose and utility and is also just beautiful. And so having realizations and learning things like that, it just completely changes the way you look at your yard. You don't just see grass with some weeds popping up. You see a whole community of different kinds of plants and beings that are interconnected in different ways. And so and for me personally, like I've had to look a lot towards the way that people outside of the colonial system did live and still do live in some parts of the world. I've had to look a lot towards that to find what resonates with me now as I try to move towards this outlook of just, I guess, humbling myself and trying to learn a bit more about just the plants, the trees, all the different life around me. And to not see myself as like the thing in charge trying to conquer and, you know, all that stuff. So, man, I really appreciate all your points there. And maybe that's a good chance to listen to the album version of the song, because it's the same song. You're doing the same thing, but the performance is slightly different. The vocals are a bit more upfront. And now with that context, I think it'd be nice to just listen again, if that's all right with you.
Right on.
Let's do it. Okay.
Thank you. it's gonna be fine soon.
That's great. I thought of something there. Do you have a little more time, Daniel?
Yeah, I'm just hanging out, man.
Okay. I thought of something there that I wanted to ask you about, because this is something that I grapple with sometimes, you know, being someone who's very interested in, for lack of a better word, the natural way of life, like, you know, just a very earthbound sense of living, where being interested in the plants and all the life here on Earth. Meanwhile, there's a lot of people who, like, there's people now who think we should try to go and live on Mars. And I have ideas pop up where, like, the first and most obvious one is like, do you think maybe we should, like, learn how to live harmoniously on this planet first before we go and try and, like, get another one? But totally. I have to say as well that I struggle to, because at the end of the day, I've got to accept that all these things are here. All these different points of view are here. And there are people working on space rockets. And that's a huge endeavor. Like, someone who's building a space rocket is pretty damn smart in some way, you know?
Yeah,
it's not something that I'm acquainted with, but, like, it's an impressive endeavor somehow, you know, even though I can't really, like, in my path, it seems a bit off the path, but, like, I try to reconcile these different points of view and ways of life. And there's an American herbalist and author that I really like. He's called Stephen Herod Buhner. He's written some books about just plants, basically. He writes a lot about plants, but in one of his last books, he had this thing where he said, because he talks a lot about the earth as a living organism, you know, with, you know, all its different parts, and humans are one of those parts. They're part of the earth's ecosystem. But, you know, just like in our bodies, each organ we have has a sort of purpose and a function, right? A role. And so he asked this question, like, what is the function, the ecological function of humans on planet Earth? What are they here to do? In if you think of the Earth as one organism, what's their purpose in that? And he proposes this thing that sort of blew my mind. He says he describes the scenario of building a space rocket, shooting out into outer space to another planet. And he likens it to an ejaculation off the planet Earth, like, boing! And
awesome.
Like, how, like a space rocket being like an ejaculation from Earth, essentially, that shoots off to another planet and can birth new life. So,
yeah, a seed.
In that sense, it's like, that brings me some great relief to imagine a situation like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that works out great unless you believe that the humans might be sort of like a bacteria on the earth, you know, like, and not even a good one at that. You know, like, if we're going to send out a seed into space, of what, you know, what are we, what plant are we trying to grow? This human species is sort of capable of some really bad decision making.
Yes. Yes. But I like to think maybe there's a greater plan at play that might just be using the humans as pawns to get the work done in some totally. In some regard. And
totally.
There's also part of me, like, is there a part of you that, like, when you were a kid, did you think like space rockets were cool a moment? You know, can't the child in you relate to that?
On my desk here, I don't know if anybody can see this or if anybody would recognize her, but this is Ursula Le Guin.
Oh, yeah. I have a little absolutely.
Ursula of Ursula K. Le Guin that I keep on my desk because she's one of my all-time favorite authors. And I mean, The Dispossessed is a book about colonization of another planet. That book really changed my mind and my life in a lot of ways. Work totally has. And, you know, even though I like music and plants and kind of earthy things, all of her books are sci-fi and they're just about people in different myths. But they're really amazing literature. If people haven't read her work or aren't familiar, Ursula K. Le Guin, The Dispossessed is a great starting point. And then The Left Hand of Darkness is the other maybe big classic. But all of her books are from the perspective of Earth or descendants of the human race that have ended up on different planets. And because Earth became uninhabitable at some point in time, everybody got sent out to different planets that were inhabitable. And then millennia have passed and all the humans that on the different planets have evolved in different ways because of ecological reasons based off of the planet that they ended up on. And so it has every planet has a different social structures and also relationships with the Earth. And it sort of drives home this point that humans are not independent of the Earth, that humans are shaped by the Earth that we're on. Mm. And so in that way, it's like, my suspicion is that they'll just try and import some sort of techno culture that's completely human created and has very little to do with the planet they're colonizing, because that's how colonization has gone for human history. Is they haven't showed up and respected the Earth or the people or the plants that were there first. And they've imported a new culture and they've in many ways tried to annihilate the culture that was there before. So to me, that's bad colonization. Yeah. But you know, to move somewhere and adopt a culture and learn or try to become into a new ecological system or sociological system, that's kind of beautiful and fun. And especially if you're not so arrogant to think that you should show up and then be in charge, you know? But that we're a student. Always.
Yes.
I mean, a bunch of things that you said are really interesting to me. The idea of, you know, the function of humans ecologically on this planet. I tried sending you a quote a little while ago and I think you ended up receiving it. It was from a book I was reading called Tending the Wild about native wildlife management practices in this area. But basically the word wild means to us untamed, untended, right? Mm-hmm. Wild horses,
right?
Or something. And the quote is something to the extent of, this is from an indigenous person, that everything that was named the wild, California, when it was called as wild expanse with cool fir valleys sort of stuff, wasn't wild. It was managed, and it was the indigenous people related to that land and interacted with it, and they altered it, and they selectively harvested and burned, and they did all of this stuff. And one of the reasons that the fire situation is so bad is that forests were immediately protected after colonization instead of being tended and managed and interacted with in the traditional ways. Yeah. It was outlawed to do anything in them.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually made this aggravated the situation a lot, which is this, like, that's another one, that word wild. We have this like relationship with it, and we have this sort of belief that the earth is like this beautiful natural thing that we shouldn't touch. But our function traditionally before colonization and before culture was to interact with the earth. Mm-hmm. That's the function of humans, was to tend and to interact and to cultivate and to coexist, not to dominate and not to leave it alone, but to be, to relate to it.
Yeah.
That's just a beautiful idea that I was not taught as a child.
Right.
I was taught that the function of humans was to get college degrees and to work for money, and all this other stuff. But if really we're here just to learn how to relate to each other and to the earth and try to do a good job of that, we probably, if we just focused on that, we might be all right for a little while long.
Yeah. I always find this idea of like save the planet to be very selfish, actually. It's like what people mean when they say that usually is like save the planet in a way that it's still hospitable to us. You know, because the planet is going to be fine after we're gone. Like it's been here a long, long time before we were here. It's already had a bunch of major extinction events and like came back thriving even stronger, So I don't think we need to worry about the planet. We only have to worry about its survivability for us. So, yeah, I did manage to find one more version of this tune, Daniel, and it's a demo version from your SoundCloud page. Do you remember putting that up there?
I did. This is even before the final version of the words.
Yeah,
were done. I think it's like partially me improvising over the musical idea and practicing playing drums at the same time.
Yeah.
And the
title is different as well. Sorry.
Totally. The other amazing thing about it is that it's kind of like it was recorded onto my boombox.
I wondered.
And
about
then
that.
I got it online by placing a 10-year-old Tascam field recorder in front of my boombox and recording the sound of the whole contraption as like a little DS card, Yeah. And so I recorded that and then put the DS card in the laptop that I still have and like figured out how to get it on to SoundCloud so that I could listen back to stuff while I was working and just kind of like listen to musical ideas and work on them.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you want to play it, it'll be interesting. I mean, probably feel really embarrassing for me, but I know you're focused on process with this podcast and
yeah,
everybody's got their own way. I just like to try and when I'm writing a song, I just like to try and come up with some sort of musical idea that makes me feel good, that I like to play. And I'll just play it over and over and over again and try and find without using a pencil or paper. Usually I'll just try to find some words that fit the theme or that try to create a theme with words. Just trying out the musical idea, and usually some gem will come from an initial improvisation or three or four, and then I'll write that down and start trying to compose like a more of a finished lyric off of that. And usually always finish the lyric on the do a lot of poetry, so interact with words on a a big part of the process, but this recording is before anything ended up on the page. And it's also what's interesting, and maybe I'll say that afterwards if you just want to play it. I won't front load it too much.
Okay. Well, there is a very subtle difference in the lyrics, which to me is very intriguing. And I don't even know if we should get into it, but maybe we should listen to it and check that out. And if you have another point, we can get back to that then. Okay.
Give it a go.
Let's check it out, man.
What's it called?
It's called Changing the Weather is the name of the tune.
Changing the Weather.
Yeah. And I'm glad you told me about how it was recorded, because I thought it was some sort of boombox contraption. It sounds like you're like literally pressing play and stop on something. And I find sound quality of that quite charming. And also at the end, you kind of cut loose pretty well at the end of this version. So I like that as well. So let's check it out.
Oh, the rooster.
Yeah.
That's Taylor coming home at the end of that. We have the bells on our door. You could hear at the end of the recording. Hilarious.
Can you guess what is the lyrical change that I'm intrigued by?
That's the meat eating version.
Yes.
That's the one you heard when I was like,
see, that the one thought is process
about chicken and rice instead of broccoli process, and rice.
Yeah. Sorry, I keep interrupting you. We've got a bit of a lag here, so
good.
Jumping in is like a bit difficult sometimes. But the thought process in my head was, did Daniel consciously decide to change it to broccoli and rice just in case there's any plant-based people listening to the song, and so that, you know, it might speak to more people? Because maybe there's more people that appreciate broccoli these days than appreciate eating chicken. Like, did that cross into your mind?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember. I also just like the word broccoli.
Yeah.
It's such a funny word. I just really like that word broccoli. And I really like broccoli. I thought about it from that perspective, too, of like, you know, if anybody wanted to sing along and they were vegetarian.
Right.
But then like the kids that hate broccoli probably won't sing along, but it's good. It made my farmer friend laugh. I sent my farmer friends the video a couple of days ago, and the next morning, like early in the morning, Fred was driving by on the tractor and he turned off the tractor and he's like, "Hey Daniel, next time the weather is nice, let's have broccoli and rice."
Nice.
Really like nice. It. But it also is because of Greg Eldridge. We in high school, we kind of all wrote a song, David and I and Greg, where the chorus was this really beautiful, like two or three part harmony thing. And Greg wrote the words, and the words were, am I back here?
You're back.
The words were, destiny pattern free. Broccoli, celery. And we, you know, you sing each of the words really slow, and so it's kind of the song is cruising by. Destiny pattern free, broccoli, celery. And it always got a laugh, and it's so good to make people laugh. I mean, yeah. You're like, otherwise you're at the singer songwriter concert and the singer songwriter is kind of playing their serious songs, you know. And but then if somebody says the word broccoli, you might, you know, somebody might laugh.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It made me smile. Definitely.
Yeah. Broccoli is so cool. It's such a friendly plant. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Every step of the way. I like the whole brassica family. Uh-huh. They're good buddies. I like the kales, the cabbages.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that all those food plants that you just mentioned, they all come from the same species of plant. They're just different cultivars of the brassica.
They look really similar when they're babies, kind of like humans. We all just look like these little babies.
Yeah.
But then we kind of individuate, and we got people who kind of stake out their claim on the, but it's all the same stuff.
Yeah. Man, hey, I wanted to ask you one more thing before I let you go. Do you happen to have a copy of your new little book there around?
No, you do. Oh, I can see one in the back there.
Mine's
on the other side of the building.
Okay,
I can grab one from the other side of the building.
You mean the other side of your yurt?
Yeah, but I'd have to leave my little... here.
Well, that's okay. I was going to ask you if you would leave us with a passage from the book.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Okay, well, yeah, let me go grab one copy then.
Okay.
You can kind of show it while I'm getting it there.
Yeah. Here it is, everyone. This is Daniel's little book. Peggy Pilgrim of the Heart, it's called. And it's got his lovely illustrations. And the inside is kind of like, it's like kind of like little cartoon comics a bit, and then also some just poetry. So and before you do this, I think this would be a great way to just end. We could just end it as soon as you're finished here. So I'll say thank you now, and maybe if people want to find you, it's Daniel Dickerson. You're on all the platforms as Daniel Dickerson, aren't you?
Totally. Man, but I think I was just working on it this... that's my undercover online name. Mm-hmm. But I was just working on it this morning. Hopefully in the next couple of days, or maybe not till Tuesday, as I'm trying to set as the formal release. But I'm going to release this album of songs as probably well some other stuff finally and put it up on Spotify. And yeah. I've been working on making my own Bandcamp page. I've sort of like covered my tracks over the years, making albums and sharing them with my friends, and then sort of like taking them offline again.
Yeah.
You know, funny habit I've had for years. I don't know if other people ever do this, but I kind of like it. It has its little moment in time, and then it gets stagnant if it stays there.
Well, so, I would, but my stuff was released on some record labels that own the rights to share this stuff. So some of that stuff does embarrass me. And I do sometimes wish that I could disassociate from it, you know? So I understand that, but we'll hopefully by the time this comes out, that all that stuff you mentioned will be ready, and we can just put links to it if anyone wants to check stuff out. You also, anyone has got to check out this record. This record I've been listening to so much recently, Dream Songs for the Endless Weekend. This is you and a few friends, the Cowtown Serenaders. It's so gorgeous. Maybe we could do another chat about one of those tunes one day.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and that one I think is on Spotify. And as of this morning, I was working on a website that'll be NathanielDickerson.bandcamp.com.
Great.
And it'll have some of this stuff.
Cool.
And I might be going through and trying to like share some of the older recordings, but with new artwork, because I like making the artwork all fresh.
Yeah.
So if anybody's into that type of stuff, you can follow me. The other thing that I do the most is I just have a phone. My laptop's kind of old. I just have my little phone, and I make Instagram posts every once in a while of art or music or songs. And I play sort of as a job other than farming. And definitely this was my full-time job before the pandemic, is I played jazz and folk and country music, traditional material and covers and all that sort of stuff. And so sometimes I'll just like share a video of me playing an old jazz tune.
Yeah.
So everybody likes old tunes. We didn't talk about that much, but I'm just sort of obsessed with old music and old records and tapes and listening to the radio. And I just love all that stuff. And it feels like even that it's another conversation, but that kind of like the colonist mentality of show up and populate an arena with your own ideas as a songwriter. It's
really
easy to show up and be like, hey, everybody, I've written these songs. They are the only songs that matter, but they're not. And so many amazing musicians and songwriters have come before. And so just a big part of my life and my practice is learning old music and learning about old musicians. And so, so sometimes I share that stuff online, but not much.
I love the way you put that. So, well, next time we do this, we'll talk about a song that you know that has lots of different versions, and you know, like we'll maybe get into like, you know, just a classic song that is.
Oh my god!
Yeah, let's do that next time.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, but man, please share a passage from your little book if you will, and we'll say goodbye for this time.
Yeah. Well, thank you all. Thank you all for listening. Whoever's out there, I'm sort of, it's just me and Peter right now on the screens, but in theory, somebody somewhere is going to be putting this on their little device and it'll be flying through their headphones. And it's just a pleasure to meet you this way. I hope we run into each other all somewhere down the line. And I'll read this poem here. The book that I made is called Peggy Pilgrim of the Heart. And it's just poems, comics. Some of them sort of are part of an ongoing story that I've been, that's been playing in my head for the last 10 years about my friends, Totap and Tommy and Peggy Pilgrim and the town where they live called Cowtown. But this one didn't come from that world. This one was just written. It was written the morning when I learned that Diane DePrima had passed away. And Diane DePrima is an American poet. If anybody's interested in the history of poetry and you don't know her, look her up. She's really, she's a legend in my mind. and in certain circles, and she's kind of one of the only women poets and writers that was part of the beat scene. But she moved to the California Bay Area in the late 60s and 70s, and she was raising children while writing and working. And she's associated with a few famous communes in this area. And she's a really interesting lady, has a couple of memoirs out too, that are really worth reading. And then her poetry is just an incredible body of work. And it's incredibly lit up from a revolutionary perspective. She was a real radical thinker and anti-war activist and human rights and ecological rights activist, and I think was totally spot on with everything and was ahead of her time and was also give voice to people that came far, far before her and trying to keep that spirit alive. So this is called "The War is Over" for Diane de Prima, 1934 through 2020. 100,000 forget-me-nots reach for you, while paradise music vibrates the earth and everybody starts dancing. Big rain clouds proliferate in the soil and rain towards the sky, forming green meadows by the empty highways. We play in those meadows like barefoot children, and nobody asks why. Because the war is over. Nobody asks why. They just say, and wonder what else is possible. There you go. And that, for anybody who doesn't think so, to me, that sentence or that phrase, "the war is over," that's a false statement. We're still in the middle of it. So that's a utopian poem there, but we've still got some work to do.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, Peter. Thank you. And once again, thank you to everybody out there who's listening and thinking of you, and I'm holding you in my heart and in my head, even though I'm not in the same room as anybody, but looking forward to that day when it comes.